The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media. Download Windows Media Player 10 at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.
So who should I be? Who should I be? Who should Lockernome be acquired by and why?
Well, actually, I think Yahoo, because they're already looking for people to be their tech gurus and to create content about it.
Really?
Yeah.
Yahoo's in that market?
Yeah, last week they added financial guys, like five different people to write content. The week before that, it was Kevin Seitz to cover wars for him.
Wow.
So I would definitely say Yahoo.
Interesting. And they have been on a spending spree lately.
They have.
I could probably get about $100, maybe $200 out of Yahoo, and I think that's a fair, if I do all the valuations of the reporting and everything, I think that's about where it's at after all my debt.
I don't know, after what Jason got for Weblog Think.
I don't know, Mitch. I think that's awfully bubblish to me. And I don't even know if we've even begun to hit a renaissance yet. With this whole this Web 2.0 thing, but I don't know.
Not even close, but now the money's starting to flow. There's no doubt about it. I mean, this week was phenomenal.
Dang.
And by the way, Weiner did sell.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. For VeriSign has confirmed it.
Was that undisclosed sum, or was it about $5
million? Silicon Beat, the Mercury News says it was $2
million. Wow. That's still pretty decent. That's not bad,
considering all I did was just sort of host things for a few years.
Not to stretch too far from what I want to talk to you about, but how do you think that's going to play out? Is VeriSign now, Jake kind of speculated with me here, that VeriSign would very well charge ping providers or people who would ping weblogs.com or now Verizon.
I didn't say they'd charge the VeriSign. People who would ping them. I said they'd charge the people who want to use the ping data.
Oh.
I think it's going to be a different way. I think that they're going to charge for services eliminating spam pings and eliminating spam trackbacks. So what they do is they say, we register everybody, so we know who everybody is. And if you want a clean feed, or if you want to be let in and be a verified pinger, there might be a couple of different ways they could charge them.
Now, that's very valid, because I can tell you that a lot of my search feeds that used to be clean are now flooded with junk.
Yeah.
Flooded.
So the other thing is, you would register as a website host and say, make sure that you're skimming out all of the crap that's going on to my site. And that's a $90 a year service.
That'd be something I'd pay for. Even with my current blog host, I'd pay extra for that.
Sure.
It's seriously to the point where every time I get ready to, turn on some comments or trackbacks, I hear nightmare stories about, just being absolutely overwhelmed, regardless of the solutions that are in place or the new upgrades with the blacklists. And it's getting worse. It's not getting better in my mind.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Movable Type broke its blacklist plugin, so I'm having that problem every day.
It broke it? You mean with...
The 3.2 release, they did something that broke it, and so it hasn't caught up yet. So.
See, I upgraded to 3.2, and I'm having an issue every 6 hours or so. My server tells me that I need to upgrade again, and I have no idea why, and they have no idea why this is happening. I have no idea why. I don't know. Movable Type seemed like a great solution at the time, but there seem to be more and more offerings on the planet now, more than just Movable Type as it used to be. Just Movable Type was really the best solution.
I still like it. It does a lot of good things for me, and I'm sure when it's fixed, I'll be able to, I won't have to delete everything by hand. Right now I get the opportunity to at least not have it published before it goes out.
That's better than Ponzi's website is just full. She doesn't. The trackbacks, the way we use Blogware as our host, which is Two Cows, and it's horrible in certain respects. We don't get notifications of spam trackbacks. So I'll go to an old entry of hers, and it'll be all any kind of spam, Texas Hold'em and Vioxx, et cetera, just on the page about it was about something else. It's horrible. It's just getting absolutely horrible to the point where I don't even think it's worth having on anymore.
Yeah, I wonder, because I'm getting spam these days that even looks like it's not spam, and it's just it's Somebody found an old posting about the fact that we self-published the Extreme Democracy book, and so then they put a posting on that said, hey, you know, anybody can be a published author now, and it sounded like they were addressing me, and it turned out they were just hawking publishing services.
Wow. I've had a couple of those. I mean, if they're genuine, I at least appreciate the effort that they put into spamming it instead of just, you know, blanket like, this is good enough. That's always nice to see every once in a while, but not easy to deal with, certainly. So
anyway, I think, you know, we all ought to gang together and take full advantage of the fact that after the publishers, the bloggers are the ones who are going to start making the money.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I've been writing about it all week. Once this... this looks a lot like what happened in magazines when desktop publishing came along. Suddenly there were a whole lot of magazines, and so most magazines didn't pay well. As some magazines began to succeed, they began to pay well, and, you know, to writers. And I think you're going to see basically the same phenomena in the blog space. And so the other day I said, I think in the next, I think it was 2 years, that 10,000 bloggers would be taking jobs that used to be held by journalists or that had never been before, just were brand new jobs.
Now,
because they work cheap.
Well, you know, and it doesn't, with a lot of the people out there not necessarily needing a million-dollar lifestyle, you know, I know plenty of people who write very well and who live in remote locations where it doesn't cost a lot of money to live or to have a good quality of life, and certainly they don't
Absolutely.
Need to be paid as much.
It's the distributed economy.
Yeah. Now, does that play very well into your concept of paramedia at all?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, we can do the backup, and I can tell you why I think this is the right word to describe what happens.
Certainly.
First off, you know, before I even say anything, I'm not trying to name what blogs and wikis and everything are. Blogs and wikis and the people who use them, you know, those are tools, and those are creative people. But what I'm trying to figure out is what happens when people start collecting their efforts and trying to exert some influence in the market, whether it's the political marketplace or the economic marketplace. Doesn't really matter. So what I started looking at is what happened when people started to be able to afford a gun, just anybody, you know, instead of the king's men. And if you look at history, there were a few hundred years there where firearms were completely out of the reach of any normal person. And then, you know, in the 1700s, a lot of people got hold of guns. American Revolution happened. French Revolution happened. And during the French after the French Revolution, when Napoleon was in power, there were these guerrilla attacks in Spain, which was just a bunch of individual communities getting together and fighting. And they actually drove Napoleon's armies out of Spain. It was the first nation to do that. So this old established military structure, you know, big, slow-moving, hundreds of thousands of men were beaten by dozens of people using guerrilla tactics. So then, about 100 years later, guerrilla tactics were organized, and they were, you know, they were being applied systematically, like across an entire region. And that time, they started calling this paramilitary. In other words, it's an organized group of attacks and people being trained to act like an army, even though they weren't in the army. So if you look what happened to warfare in the 20th century, you know, you've got guerrilla armies in places like Afghanistan beating the Russians. You've got a guerrilla army in or a paramilitary in Iraq giving us one hell of a time. You've got Al-Qaeda, which is the sort of ultimate distributed net paramilitary, which strikes fear into every corner of the earth whenever they happen to mention something about Bali or... I guess New York is under a terror attack right now because they said something about blowing up a subway.
Yeah.
So as you get... you know, what this is like is the availability of publishing tools. Publishing tools have gone from being extremely hard to get and even harder to, once you printed something, get it out to people. Or if you wanted to broadcast something, you had to build a massive network which established what was essentially a permanent connection between any producer and the audience, to the peer-to-peer environment where you've got everybody able to be a publisher and to reach an audience on an ad hoc basis. And so we're in a situation where with the press democratized to the same degree that guns have been democratized over the past 350 years, that you're going to see the beginning of organizations of people who say, you know, with your press and my press, whether that's a blog or whatever, we can change people's thinking about stuff. And so, you know, it's sort of the ultimate expression of the pen is going to be mightier than the sword, because the pen can work together for the first time in a coordinated and distributed way. And so that's what I was trying to capture when I said, this is paramedia. It's any organized effort to take these tools and conduct a campaign of changing people's perception or opinions.
Do you think that now that Weblogs Inc. has been acquired by AOL, is Weblogs Inc. still a part of the paramedia, if you would have considered them part of it in the first place?
Well, you know, the thing is, this is one of the reasons paramedia is a good word, is that paramilitary also exist as extra-governmental forces. So, you know, a paramedia can include the bullies that the president or the dictator send out to intimidate people. So, yeah, they could certainly be. Weblogs, Inc. could be part of the paramedia if, for instance, AOL wanted to, you know, get everybody talking about a new movie coming out from Time Warner.
And that's kind of what Weblogs, Inc. has traditionally done anyway, where if one of their blogs makes a post that they think will get a lot of traction, all of their other blogs will point at it.
Right. And it's that coordinated pointing so that you get the, you know, the aggregation of influence so that you drive traffic somewhere.
But isn't that kind of false though, Mitch? I mean, in the sense that, you know, you're generating traffic by pointing traffic back to yourself, traffic that you control. Doesn't that make, you know, it make news kind of false news?
Paramedia is a value neutral word. It describes something that can be used for good and something that can be used for bad. And in this case, bad is propaganda. It's made up information that's represented as, you know, reality. Mm. So, yeah, absolutely. It is cheesy as hell. We shouldn't allow it. We should be really looking for people who are starting to do this kind of stuff.
But wait, we've allowed that. If that's the case of, you know, and it's, I'm not saying it's good or bad, but mm-hmm. if Weblogs Inc. does that, then shouldn't they be taken to task, or had they not been taken to task until now? Or
well, you know, they have at various times, you know, for either not being entirely transparent about who their sponsors were, and this is not just Weblog Inc. It's been a discussion that's gone on for a while.
Oh, certainly.
I mean, remember when Marquee hired the bloggers?
Yep.
Well, you know, I happen to have been one of the bloggers, and, you know, I know Eric Rice, who's in the chat, was one of the bloggers, and the other thing is that I committed the sin of writing the contract that Marquee used. But, you know, the thing was, we used it in different ways. That is, the bloggers. Some of us said, you know, this is totally... I'm taking this money, and I'm going to tell you, in my case, I said once a week, go check them out. They sponsor the site. They make it possible for me to spend more time. Mm-hmm. Other people wrote stories about Marquee as though they were, you know, really interested in Marquee and not just in the money. And other people ultimately were asked by Marquee, and this is why the program ended, to, you know, sort of republish things that they wanted out there. And at that point, the whole network fell apart because everybody recognized that was wrong.
Yeah.
But it was perfectly fine, I think, for the experimentation that happened in the various degrees of involvement with Marquee and the disclosure of the involvement. As long as it was fairly transparent, you know, you can judge somebody for what they said and why they said it. But if you don't know that there might be another motive, you can't make that judgment. So transparency is the important thing.
How does transparency fit into paramedia?
That's a great question. That's probably the question that is still totally unresolved. Although, interestingly enough, if you think about what VeriSign could do, where I could also sign up for a system that says, show me who, or, you know, what sites are owned, or what sites are using the advertising from a particular company, so that I could always say, you know, and this is actually giving away a little of the technology that I'm working on with my startup, but... You know, if I could look at that and look at web pages with that information that said, you know, this is a heavily sponsored site that talks Audi, that talks about almost nothing but Scandinavian cars. There's a reason I might think, you know, they may not really be telling me the truth or what they really feel. And so if you have information about it, I think, you know, we're all smart people. And as much as we say, you know, that the press should recognize that the individual blogger is just as valid a source of information or opinion, we also need to recognize that the individual consumer of information is smart enough to make these decisions if they're provided the information. But once bloggers start hiding those things, just like the big press has always done, it's really bad. You start threatening the very essence of democracy.
Well, but that's happened, you know, in more of a way than what was done with Marquee. I mean, there was a large amount of transparency and, of course, a lot of buzz about the program of paying bloggers essentially paying bloggers to talk about this product or just, you know, mention it, yeah. The fact, you know, the sponsorship. And, hey, I'm no stranger to sponsorship. Believe me, I've been taking a task.
No, really?
Yeah. This is my living. You know, some people, you know, go into work. This is my work. So,
right.
You know, I make no bones about that. But I think there have been cases where it's happened. We didn't realize it was happening. And I mean, this is, it's nothing new. I think the problem, much like spam, is going to get worse. It's going to happen. What it takes usually is to be able to pick up on patterns, and seeing things, and seeing repetition where there isn't typically, repetition. And, it's that kind of, I don't know, what's the opposite of transparency? Opaqueness.
Opacity.
Yeah, opacity. And I think you're going to see a lot of efforts happen, I guess, in opacity rather than transparency, largely because of not only the benefits. The benefits, I think, will outweigh the risks to go an opastic, an opacity route versus a transparent route.
I agree. Absolutely. The benefits outweigh the risks. The problem is that as long as we keep the benefits in mind and constantly press to eliminate the risks by, you know, forcing people to be as open as possible, we're doing the kind of work that, you know, citizens should be doing with the government, holding people accountable. I mean, if somebody lies to you, you know, like, say, a president. you know, for the last 5 years, because it's been a crisis situation, the argument has always been, well, you know, you can't question the president because it's a crisis and he knows what's best for us. And that's not the mindset that got this country or the world where it should be, or, you know, where it is today, or where it was 5 years ago. I mean, you gotta stand up and call bull on people who are lying to you, or who are creating the impression that, you know, they all believe something when in fact they are only doing that in order to achieve some goal.
Well, people are doing it, but the problem is, you know, you mentioned politics is a subject matter. As soon as I, you know, call George Bush to task, then I'm accused of playing, you know, partisanship. And
right. And
so it's not – the message is diluted somehow because of my political alliances. If I happen to – no, even if I've come out and said – and this is by no means true or necessarily false because I haven't been very public about my political beliefs. If I were to come out and say I'm a Republican and yet admonish Bush, people are going to take – as our current president, people are going to take that with a grain of salt because they're thinking, well, is he saying that because he believes it, or is he really saying that he is a Republican but not really a Republican? Is he being truthful about this stuff? What's his track record? Is his track record true? Is he a shill? Has he?
I know what you mean.
You can't trust anybody.
Here's the thing: for the last 25 years, this was a strategy of the extreme right, was to discredit the media as much as possible. And one of the things that they ultimately did was say, you know, and look, I'm not passing judgment on these people. I'm just making a statement, okay, because you can read my blog if you want to know what I think about the president. I, you know, don't like him, and I don't like a lot of the things that the Republicans do. I also don't like a lot of things Democrats do. But the fact that you express your opinion is not being is not bad. Partisanship and politics, that is, you know, in a democracy, arguing about where the country should go, is a good thing. But there was a concerted effort to label any disagreement as political in a bad sense, as partisan, you know, not constructive was is the implication of the word today. Right? So I think we ought to reclaim the fact that we should be able to have as many arguments as we want. I mean, we're Americans. I want to argue with my neighbors, you know, about what they're doing to their yard if their yard is, you know, like leaking toxic sludge onto mine. Or if, you know, somebody's speeding down the street, I want to go out there and say, hey, dude, my kids are out here playing. Slow down. And if I say the same thing in a political context to, you know, the president, hey, dude, you know, my kids are being left behind because you're not funding what you're you claim you are. That's just a good, you know, democratic argument. We ought to have these kinds of things. But, you know, the other thing is just there is a paramedia example that just came up in the last few days. It's the Armstrong-Williams Department of Education thing, which the Government Accountability Office just came out and said, you know, that was silly, where the DOE paid $250,000 to a columnist who wrote a column, and then a group of conservative bloggers picked up on the column and used it to drive support for the No Child Left Behind bill. And it was paid for by the U.S. government. So you're seeing paramedia emerge in a lot of different areas already. I don't think this is something that's, you know, new. I think it's just starting to think about it as how do you identify the networks of influence that you need to be aware of as an informed citizen or an informed consumer, or as a person who wants to participate in this debate without being overwhelmed by people who just show up and say, we're going to attack you arbitrarily until you shut up and just let us have our way.
So in putting a word to this idea, what was your hope?
To get people to start thinking about the power relationships in this network. I mean, there's an assumption, and I co-wrote a book about this and co-edited a book about emergent democracy. And there's this kind of feeling that if everybody just gets together, goodness is going to happen. And I don't think that's true. I think you have to exercise a great deal of diligence in the practice of governing or democracy or whatever you call it to avoid ending up in a bad situation, whether that's dictatorship, totalitarianism, communism, or whatever. You know, you just have to be aware, and you have to start looking at it that way. And so I'm, you know, hoping that people will kind of pick up on this idea and recognize that when they see those networks starting to evolve, that that is a form of positive action or propaganda. And, you know, a paramedia that says, we're going to make sure that everybody finds out about the really bad situation in New Orleans for the poor was a great thing. I mean, that was a form of paramedia, too. And the next step, I hope, besides the fact that I'm working on, you know, algorithms and software that are hoping to identify this kind of stuff and make that information available on the net, is that people will think about how to build transparency into these discussions. And, you know, I mean, I just think we assume everything's going to be all right if we just, you know, all just take the same LSD.
Yeah, yeah. When you talk about this term, it's a new term, but it's not a new idea. It stretches well beyond the realm of politics. You know, you use the word consumer.
Yeah.
And in saying that, it's a broad stroke that is really I guess defining or putting a finer point on elements that are already there in these greater communities, or I guess smaller communities. I mean, really targeted communities in whatever the focus happens to be.
And it could be, you know, it can be very narrow. It could be, you know, a state, a group of people within a state talking about a policy. It could be really big and broad, like the Lincoln French Fry and the blog that was supposedly set up. And, it turned out that Yahoo participated in that and was behind it along with a major PR firm. That's a form of paramedia, too.
But is that true paramedia, or... I guess.
Remember, paramilitaries can be deployed by individual people getting together and deciding, say, let's overthrow the government.
Right.
But it can also be deployed by the government. And in a lot of cases, paramilitaries are deployed by private interests who want to protect their property or their influence in a nation. So there's a company called Executive Outcomes that was a South African company that was hired by oil companies to go into Nigeria and make sure that the oil was available to them. So remember that paramedia doesn't have to necessarily be just a lot of small individuals. It can be a lot of individuals or a lot of organizations working in concert for pay or for, you know, government, for a share of power in government.
The blogosphere has been paramedia.
The blogosphere individually, though, I mean, that's remember what I said right at the beginning. It's not saying blogs are paramedia. It's
right.
saying that it's like saying that guns are like blogs, or the pen and the sword are equally available to everybody now. It's when they get organized and used in a particular way that they become paramedia or paramilitary.
Is that like a flash mob of sorts? Only, I guess, less temporary, something with a little more staying power than a flash mob?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think a flash mob is kind of an impressionistic thing, right? You know, it just sort of happens and people take whatever from it that they're going to take. But a protracted effort to, you know, change people's perception would be paramedia. How does that happen? Well, in order to get enough people who, you know, care to do the same thing, their interests have to be aligned at the same time. And, you know, we know in politics that, and you can see this right now in the Republican Party and the split that's going on over Harriet Myers, Republican interests have all suddenly become unaligned, and so their coalition is falling apart. They may put it back together, who knows? But in politics, in consumer situations, you've got different companies or different organizations that have something they want to get out there in common, and so they'll support one another. And there are groups of bloggers who will say, you know, I believe that, and I'll support it for any number of reasons. You know, a good example of those kinds of interests aligning was when Jeff Jarvis went after Dell. And you had a lot of people who read Jeff's blog who say, I had a crappy experience with Dell, too. And then you also had a lot of people who said, you know what the problem is that Dell didn't respond to the bloggers the way they should have. And their interest was, you know, the role of bloggers. And so these two separate interests aligned around Jeff's postings. And Jeff also made sure that he drove the postings really effectively by, you know, repeatedly bringing this back up and talking about how Dell had responded to him. And so he got people, you know, two very, you know, large, in terms of influence, groups of people together around an idea. And it ends up in Business Week, and it ends up changing Dell's strategy. So that would be a paramedia event as well.
Would conferences play into paramedia?
Sure, they could.
Traditional conferences. And
yeah, sure they could.
Happened
with Web 2.0 this week.
Oh, okay. Well, were you there?
No, but
okay, I'm
look
asking.
At all the transactions that happened.
Okay. In a traditional sense, that's paramedia, you know, certainly there's a commingling with what happens at conferences. But how can a conference better act as a funnel for this, more so than they have in the past? Do you have...
Well, you know...
It's just more kind of like...
More
so
than they have in the past.
Yeah.
You know, the difference is there are a lot more conferences today and unconferences, although as far as I can tell, unconferences or conferences without a high price tag. I used to run a conference, you know, 10, 12 years ago called Digital World, and we would get all these people together, and there'd be a lot of deals. It was a lot like Web 2.0 before the net came along and as the net was emerging. And as you know, from organizing GNOME Dex, it's everything you put in place before the conference determines what's going to happen at the conference and its influence in the world. That is, how much it gets covered, how many people talk about it on their blogs, how many people say, I have to be there. And so I think the problem that we have today is that there is there's a lot more conference to choose from. And being very focused around not just one issue, but one issue that brings a group of several different groups of people together, which I think, you know, GNOME Dex has done several times, not to kiss your ass just because I'm on your show. But
no,
Web 2.0 did that too. They did that, you know, because there's all this talk about Web 2.0. O'Reilly's been, you know, hashing this idea of the participatory culture. There's a number of companies that have early stage funding that are looking for more funding. There's a number of VCs that have been just waiting for, you know, the right story to show up in the paper that's going to make them, you know, invest. And if anybody's listening that's a VC right now, give me a call because I've got that. Conferences, whether they're virtual or real, are all about, you know, creating setting. And that setting is the place where a number of different interests can coalesce at one time.
All right, Mitch, if you had one thing to say to Eric Rice, what would it be right now?
To Eric Rice?
Yeah.
That's a loaded question.
Now, I'm asking this for a reason, because Eric Rice has joined us on the line.
Oh, hi, Eric. How you doing?
I would stop you right there before.
There's a big secret thing that I was involved in that I can't talk about. And that's what I'd like to say something smart-ass about. But then, if I were going to say, Eric, my one thing to say to you, be yourself. You bring a lot of people together around you, and that's what leadership is. A lot of people don't, you know, when we talk about emergence, everybody says, no one's in charge anymore. Well, no, anyone can lead is the big thing, and Eric's done that.
Well, thank you, but I think it's actually important that you get out there. I think for any leader to get out there and physically do, you know, get your hands dirty.
Yeah,
Eric, you called for a reason. I'm just curious now.
It was actually about the Dell situation, because we know about Jeff Jarvis writing about Dell and talking about Dell and everything, and everybody said, "Yeah, I've had that miserable experience with Dell." You know, great example of paramedia, which, by the way, Mitch, I really like that term. And then I had a conversation the other day with somebody who's like, "Man, you got to get these Dell monitors." I said, "Oh, Dell, ew," and I told them the story. And these are people of probably just the rank and file citizenry who said, that might be the case, but it's a great deal, man. You just got to pick up these monitors." And I'm wondering how you would recommend going about selling the concept of paramedia. You know, because in a way, you've got this huge reach of all these traditional media outlets, and then you have paramedia, which potentially flies right under the radar. So, you know, yeah, there might be this very important cause, but, you know, who cares? You know, so the selfish rank and file, if you will. How would you sell it?
You mean sell it in the sense of Dell? You could take advantage of the fact these guys are happy?
Well, no, I think if I'm getting what Eric's asking, sell it in the sense that if I'm watching, like, television, if it's not important to be on television, it's not important. You know, a lot of the people who get most of their information from traditional media, you know, they look at the internet and blogging as, yeah, it's interesting stuff, but if it's not on the 6 o'clock news, it's not that important. How do you get to them? No, it is today. But I think it's still going to be for the foreseeable future, people are still going to turn to tell. I mean, for instance, I had this exact same thought last night. I was watching The Daily Show thinking, why aren't, you know, why are we not doing things that are important enough that they're going to bring up the fact that, you know, this big acquisition just happened in the software world? Because 90% of the, no, I'm sorry, 99% of the planet just doesn't give a rip. Even 99% of the country doesn't care. They're focused on politics. They're focused on, you know, some of the bigger things that are happening.
Well, right, but the thing is that the percentage of the company, the country that is currently going to, you know, consider buying a monitor is a substantially smaller, and demographically unique. I mean, with the broadest definition demographics you can come up with. But I mean, if you can find people who are interested in buying a monitor at that time, that's El Dorado in terms of what the, you know, the advertising and marketing companies are looking for.
And actually, to Dell's credit, those monitors are essentially the same monitors that you can get from Apple for twice the price.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Well, that Dell example,
not
you know,
quite
was
as
just,
right, but you know.
Yeah, there's the Dell example was just one. You know, this actually can transcend any type of industry. I remember hearing somebody giving me static about a hardware store and then another about a fruit beverage. It's like, well, don't you know that the management of that company does X? I'm like, I have no idea. I need plywood, or I don't know. I'm just thirsty, man. I just, you know, and while those things are important to me, and there's this entire paramedia conversation going on around that, I'm suddenly just caught up in the moment of I'm really thirsty, or just, geez, man, I need some hammer and nails. I'm going to go to the
closest place. But you know, the thing is, that's because those are not concerted efforts now. People do, you're talking about what is essentially random activity where they say, because they happen to run across the Dell thing, they say, oh, but I like these monitors. But what the Dell or those people have not done is get together to really drive the idea that the monitors are great and everybody should be buying them. And so, going back to your thing about the juice or the plywood company, if I told you and 100 other people that you read who happen to be in your RSS aggregator said, you know, every time you buy one of those juices, they kill a pelican.
Right.
And I just repeated that over and over and over. Eventually, I'm going to have in your head, you're going to be standing at the store and you're going to say, well, I could buy the energy drink, or I could buy this juice where they kill the pelican. I don't want to buy a juice where they kill a pelican. And so this idea has been put into your head. And that's the kind of, you know, mimetic warfare that we're talking about.
And my job here is to be the devil's advocate. I completely agree.
Sure,
I just need to advocate the devil's side.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily the devil's side. I've had experiences, I mean, long before Jeff brought it to light, people have been having problems with Dell. And it's not... I don't know if it's the whole of Dell. I think it's just a fraction of it. It's their laptop division. Their laptops have sucked for years. I mean, just beyond sucked. But you'll find lesser complaints with people who have Dell monitors, Dell desktops. These are all different
right.
divisions, all different kinds of hardware, all different approaches. It's their laptops that suck. It's not necessarily Dell as the whole, unless, of course, you're going to accuse Dell of not being a part of the conversation, in which case, what are they going to say? Honestly, what is Dell going to be able to say to make this better? They know that this is never going to bubble up to CNN's level where this blogger says that Dell sucks. That's not news. I can sit there and say that...
Well, the thing is, it got into Business Week. That affected their stock. So it can rise. Now... So the question may be not, you know, how can we make the technology industry more relevant to other people, but how can we pick the issues that make technology relevant to people? And, you know, there are some that we know, you know, really get people going. Privacy, customer service, you know, there are a lot of them. You know, how is this affecting my job? Am I going to be outsourced because this computer lets them, you know, move the data somewhere else? There's a lot of those kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
but what you're describing in the, you know, the silos of the Dell organization are a whole bunch of different audiences that they're selling to. I mean, I would never buy a Dell laptop,
Well, that's because you're a Mac guy.
I will generally not buy anything that runs Windows. But if I were looking for something that was buying Windows or that would run Windows, you might get me, given my technical sophistication, to pay attention to something by being on Chris's site or by being on ZDNet or somewhere else. But also, look, we're all mutant geeks in the sense that we really fixate on this stuff and spend a lot of time thinking about, gee, why is it doing that? Why is the wheel spinning when it should just be done? Nobody else does. They sit there and they go, oh, I can drink some coffee now. They see most of the problems we see as significant as breaks from the computer. So the if you wanted to be a paramedia about making people more concerned about the computer, you would have to pick those messages that would appeal to the audience that you think you want to change. I mean, this is all propaganda, basically.
But wait,
if you wanted...
go ahead, finish your thought. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, this is all... What we're talking about is the problem of how do you develop propaganda. Well, and the propaganda is usually built on the truth. It is not, and what you do is you repeat the truth as much as you possibly can and ignore all the bad stuff.
See, this is where... I want to interrupt you, and I don't want to interrupt you at the same time.
No, go ahead.
Isn't paramedia kind of like propaganda in some respects?
Well, like I said, paramedia is a description of types of organizations that could be good, that is, that propagate the truth, or could be bad, which is make propaganda and distribute it.
Okay, now, Eric, what is your take when you first, assuming you looked at what Mitch has defined as paramedia, what's your take?
Oh, well, in some ways, I kind of view it as just a new angle on the old concept. And actually, you just illustrated it right there. You can use it for good. It's that alternative conversation of, just outside of what everybody else is talking about, for good or for bad, and the propaganda. I mean, when you use it to illustrate propaganda, it's like, oh, yeah. So it's just kind of the new world of we're all making media, and we're using it for good or we're using it for bad. Political or otherwise.
Yeah, a perfect example is what Jeff did with the Recovery 2.0 thing. I mean, he got this idea out there, and people are organizing around it. In fact, they're getting together to talk about it. The idea of self-organizing private efforts to help people in trouble or to recover from a disaster. And so that's an example of a bunch of people took a good idea and just started talking about it, and the idea starts to catch on, and it obviously was helped by the fact that everybody was painfully aware of how unprepared the government is for a major disaster. But on the other hand, it also appealed to people's interest in non-governmental solutions, in charity, in their obligation to their fellow citizens. I mean, it's one of those ideas. And, in the essay that I posted on my blog and the podcast that I did of it, I referred to Jeff as sort of the Che Guevara of the paramedia environment. I mean, he just knows how to pick ideas that a lot of people get really, wrapped up in.
Right. And Chris, I tend to basically agree. I mean, I'm also then you could consider in the paramedia tools business to help. I'm William Shakespeare's father. I'm not the poet. I just make the gloves.
And why do you think that is? I mean, why do you define yourself as that particular?
Well, when
character.
When I take my content hat off and I just worry about, the day job, then that's, working for a tool, working on getting tools out there for people
to have
those conversations.
But, Eric, I think a lot of people work for tools. I mean,
if I'm the boss, then that would make me the tool. What are you saying, man?
Now, do you think there's something to the idea that sites like Dig.com are becoming popular because, in a way, it is sort of a lazy man's paramedia where a bunch of people can point at something and say, hey, this is cool, go check it out?
Absolutely.
It's certainly one way to amplify things.
Yeah. And I think it also appeals to our nature of we don't necessarily always want to participate. We sometimes just want to consume.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Let me just sit down and zone out on MTV for the next couple hours. It's okay. You can do that. I mean, we get so caught up in the democratization of and the decentralization of and the participatory nature of, and it's like, well, that's great, but I'm really tired right now. I'm too tired to participate. I just want to, you know, veg out. So, yeah, things like Dig and Delicious and all of that, but, you know, that's great because I can just, it's becoming a filter. It's either a democratic filter or if there is an individual that I trust, there's a couple of Mac guys out there that they just say, try this software, and just point blank, I'll just download it because they said so. So you can put that
in. So, you know, Chris, at the beginning of the show, you were talking about, you know, the story and how the story is still important. Well, editing is still important, too, and there are different ways of editing. I mean, there's this, you know, self-organizing folksonomy, and there are people who pick what is going to be presented to you, and there are sites like Memorandum, which use an algorithm that looks at a narrow sample of sites and says, you know, what conversations start there are going to be tracked, and those therefore are important.
But see,
those are all editorial decisions.
And that to me is reeking of old media, and that's one of the things that
is.
You know,
but are we really? Are we? I mean, we're human beings. We don't completely abandon the past.
No,
we
don't
sort of do it in steps.
But that's the we're heading into the same circle again with content sites like Dig, and more so Dig than Delicious, or a site like and I'm not admonishing each one of them, I mean they're great, or Memorandum, where we're walking very dangerously down the path that turned us away from traditional media.
Absolutely. Gabe of Memorandum got really kind of chapped at me for pointing that out the other day, and came and, you know, said, wow, you're being really narrow-minded on my blog.
That's not narrow-minded, you know, at all. I mean, that's just,
all I'm doing is pointing out the fact that he says this is a conversation tracker, and I said, no, it's a conversation tracker of these conversations. It reinforces, basically, the hierarchy that he believes exists in the net.
Yep, that's absolutely true.
So,
it's old media. It's just got a new media face, in my opinion. And it's not a bad thing.
It's not
a bad thing. I use Dig. I love Dig. I love Memorandum. But I also understand that this is just a piece of it. This is not the whole of it. And the more bits and pieces that we have that we can put together, the better off we're going to be. But as these services continue to evolve, they're only going to take on an aspect of it. And Mitch, I guess you hit the nail on the head in explaining this just part of the conversation. And it is. It's only part of it.
But these new services, they're going to let us get to the stuff we want to know about faster. You know, I just picked up a new car, and now I'm joining a whole bunch of new forums. I'm injected into a whole bunch of new communities, and it's getting easier and easier to just hone in and just, boom, get the information filtered to me. And it's fine. I'm okay with somebody else putting it all out there in front of me on such a very micro level. It's certainly, you know, and I think it's the human nature of we do want to be taught and educated.
Well, there's a certain...
Yeah, and we want to belong.
No, we... Mm-hmm. There are all those
and
things.
And feeling as though you're informed is a strong feeling of belonging.
I just have a fear that some of these services are taking a lot of the serendipity out of the internet. So as more, and like I said, I'm not arguing with any of them. I mean, Slashdot for years, it's been the content that Slashdot believes is important, and it's cool when you get Slashdot because you get a lot of this traffic because you've got this targeted audience of geeks and nerds and people who love technology. But it's still that's very much old media with a new media face. The serendipity of surfing the internet and surfing blogs is that you're surfing from personal filter to personal filter to personal filter. And there are times that's good. And then there are also times, as Eric had pointed out, that where you just kind of want to veg and you want to go through someone else's filter. I just fear that as more of these services evolve, you know, they're going to lose importance, first of all, because, you know, we've got Delicious as kind of like the de facto social bookmarking tool. There are services...
For now.
But there are services that are, you know, cropping up. You could go as far as to say that Dig is a type of Delicious, just with, you know, some smarter aspects to it. There are going to be...
Yeah, but, you know, Chris, I think someday there's going to be a Dig that is, you know, the Dig just for people who really are interested in technology and its impact on media. And then there'll be a Dig for people who have ovarian cancer.
But see, again, that takes away from the serendipity of surfing the net, and I think there's more value to be gained, well, depending on your mindset at the time. But if you want information, you're going to seek information. If you want certain information to come to you, like Eric joins the car things, he wants to see these things, that's fine. But there's right. so much more, I think, to be gained by the serendipitous nature of the internet and certain alliances that you may not have necessarily known about before, and sites
right.
that aggregate kind of take away from a lot of that.
I absolutely agree with that. What I'm saying is, if we're aware of the existence of these networks, these people, you know, these paramedia efforts, we're in a better position to say, you know, I don't just want to be led down that road. I want to go down other roads, and I'm going to make choices to inject more serendipity into my reading than depending on these people.
Can't serendipity lead to confusion, though? Because the only difference between seeing, you know, 100, 300, 400 people bookmarking the same thing, digging it on Dig, and seeing 1,500 bloggers writing about it, too, it's whoever I get to first. It's the same stuff over and over and over. It's like information overload. Can serendipity lead to that?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Well,
Go
ahead, Mitch. I apologize.
Look. Life is a consistently mixed blessing. you're always going to run into the downside of this, and I absolutely agree that serendipity can be confusing and also misleading. So can collaborative filtering, and so can collaborative editing. I mean, there's a good example. I heard it at a Microsoft social networking event where somebody on Wikipedia had put up an edit on the entry about chocolate and made a statement, which it turns out was true, but was eliminated, cut out by other people on the who were editing that particular page in Wikimedia, that so many times the guy just gave up. And so the question is, how do I know this is true? Well, that's the judgment we always have to make. And one of the things that can help us make that judgment is, am I hearing this from a lot of people who have some motivation other than the truth? Tell me that.
But wait. Scoble even pointed this out in his blog when he was it's on his blog right now. It was about a rumor that was completely unfounded.
Right.
And credibility gets hurt. I mean, just because you talk about – okay, here's another point. Just because we talk about Dave Weiner and weblogs.com getting acquired by VeriSign doesn't necessarily make it true. But if I'm to write about it, and Mitch is to write about it, and Eric's to write about it, and Robert Scoble's to write about it, and O'Malik is going to write about it, all these people who have some amount of influence and weight and gravitas write about it doesn't make it any more true, but it only perpetuates that the things that they talk about are true. So it perpetuates
a false
truth.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, so the thing is, when I said earlier, well, the San Jose Mercury News has it that he did sell it. I believe the San Jose Mercury News sourced that story, right? I believe them. They're a trusted source for me. Now, on the other hand, look at what Apple does every time it sends out an intro. You know, they're going to do a new intro. And what they're counting on these days, because of their super secrecy, which they enforce by suing people, is that everybody will speculate wildly for the week beforehand so that they get all the coverage in the world. Google and Sun did the same thing with the "We're going to kill Microsoft" announcement that was absolutely nothing on Tuesday. those are traditional PR efforts.
And break it
and
down to the human level. You do that with your friends, man.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about the reality of the blogosphere, man. You get together with some friends, you'd be like, yeah, what's up? We're not going to talk about these people.
Yeah,
and we're going to bookmark these. And by the way, make a point to throw some nasty crap in your delicious feed so you can throw off your competitor. I mean, that's human nature, man. It might sound high school, but we totally, as human beings, collude and connive and work together and do all the positive things as well. But, I mean, when you take the PR and the business angle out of it, you're like, yeah, we're just not going to mention that at all. You know, we're just not going to bring it up, and somebody doesn't get ink because a bunch of influentials or friends. I mean, this is like a nasty thing nobody wants to talk about, but I think it's a reality. And that is this formula that you can see, or it's this pattern that you can see in old media and PR and new media, and it's the relationship game. It's nuts.
But
Which is also why conferences are influential, Chris.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I
look at the people.
It's
the conference monsters who go from conference to conference to conference are the ones who get all the coverage.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of strange.
Which is why I kind of avoid conferences now.
Yeah, a lot of people came to Gnomedex. I would not consider, like, conference hounds. Largely because, you know, we're not charging a metric, you know, crap load of money. Which, you know, for business purposes, we should probably do, but it's against my ethos, so I can't do it.
Right, but the thing is, people subscribe to your ethos.
They do.
You're a trusted source because of those kinds of decisions.
But at the same time, to come back to the idea of, and you know, Eric, you're saying, yes, we do this in real life. The issue is if we create a truth out of nothing, it makes it a truth even though it's not. It's one of the reasons why Snopes.com exists, to try to debunk a lot of the myths that are out there.
Right.
You know, the more we talk about something, the more it becomes true. Even though there's maybe nothing there, the more someone talks about it, the more it becomes true, whether or not it actually is true.
I think there's a mandate for a Web 2.0 business plan.
But it's scary.
Put that line in there.
Right, but that, to me, is scary. It really is.
It is, but you know, but that's you know, this is what I finished that essay where I introduced this idea with, was the idea. I said, you know, look, skepticism is a really good thing. It gets a bum rap these days because skeptics are people who, you know, like, question whether or not children should be educated about intelligent design. You know, they're bad people. Well, no, what skeptics do is ask hard questions about the truth of information so that they can get rid of the bad ideas and make more room for the good ideas. And so we have to do that, not just, you know, in paramedia campaigns, but we have to do it as people, as individuals, and as humans talking to one another about all sorts of things. You know, I mean, if Eric tells me that, you know, he actually was Jesus and is about to take the world back to God, I'd have to say, you know, if you're telling other people that, I'm going to call everyone and tell them you're wrong. And I'm going to tell them why you're wrong. I mean, skepticism is a good thing. The problem is that skeptics aren't welcomed. And this is something I've been thinking about a lot in the last few days, because I've been thinking about the nature of writing. And I have a bad attitude, or at least I'm perceived as having a bad attitude about a lot of stuff. And it's because I've always looked at things, you know, sort of from the outside and said, okay, well, what's really true? And a lot of writers all through history have been unwelcome guests at parties and events because everybody knew that if they said something embarrassing, this person was going to write it down. Nobody would invite James Joyce to a party because they'd end up in one of his books, and it would be embarrassing, you know? That otherness, that outsiderness, that thing that also says, you know, I'm not going to play the game with the blogs where I'm going to be an A-lister by, you know, linking to all the other A-listers. There's real power and value in that position in the world. And so it's perfectly reasonable to say, yeah, we could make a lot of money on a conference, but we're not going to. And it's perfectly reasonable to say, instead of saying, I'm only going to write about the things I like, I'm also going to write about the things I think are really dumb. You can be more credible, and if you write about only the things that are really dumb, you'll be credible if you're right, and most people will think you're a jerk.
But with so many voices out there, and you know, the amount of voices coming online is, well, another case in point. Ponzi's mom now has a blog. Miriam Scoble finally has a blog. Everybody now has got this a voice, and you have these masses repeating things that either are going to be worth repeating or repeating things that aren't necessarily worth repeating.
So there are reputation systems that need to be put in place in order to say, you know, this person repeats a lot of incorrect information. And
yeah,
but wait
a second, though, Mitch.
Yeah.
Who controls that reputation system? Because everybody and their grandmother is going to have their own proprietary reputation system, thereby rendering all reputation systems, like, completely useless.
Well, look, Google is already a reputation system in large part, but if you look at the way Google and PageRank work, it favors a lot of information and ideas that aren't necessarily true. I mean, you go into their video service and Google the word liberal, every source that comes up that uses the word liberal is a conservative, you know, like Fox News Network show or somebody talking on C-SPAN about the evil of liberalism. So they're doing this with automation. And, you know, Eric's absolutely right. We do it as human beings all the time. We are prejudiced. Prejudice is, you know, about making distinctions. I've decided I'm not going to believe this or that. And so I'm going to repeat that I don't believe this or that. And the multiplicity of information and the multiplicity of reputation systems will be really important over time. But somewhere down the line, hey, maybe, there will be one source we can go to say, is this person full of it or not? But I don't want to imagine what that system would look like or try to get to it, because I think that it would be an extremely dangerous system.
Well, isn't that what Steve Gilmore is attempting to do with Attention Trust?
No, I don't think so. I think that Steve Gilmore's Attention Trust is to... the problem with the Attention Trust, the way that it's envisioned now, is that any attention is intrinsically indicative of the value of the information that's being paid attention to. The reason that Seth and Jeff Yardley and these guys are in it is that they believe that you can monetize that attention. And so there's already some dynamic tension within the Attention Trust that I think you're going to see drive it in a different direction.
Yeah, I'm still having a hard time trying to wrap my head around Attention Trust. But then again,
this is what I think about all the time with my company. I mean, it's not that I'm measuring attention per se, but I'm thinking about how would you identify and track even accidental paramedia events. That is, you know, where people start out of perfectly innocent motives, repeating incorrect information or hurtful information or extremely positive information. Doesn't matter.
You talk about, you know, paramedia events as if there's a kit of sorts that someone could use to build their own paramedia event or paramedia event.
Are all over the place.
Well, how would you structure, if there was a structure, how would you put together a kit? What would you include in a kit that would make for a perfect paramedia event?
Either, well, if I told you, I'd have to kill you, wouldn't I?
Either that's a bad question or a good question. I haven't figured out.
No, it's a great question, because I just don't think that the answer is anything. There's no standard answer to that question yet. I mean, I think we're in an exploratory phase.
And plus, there are shades of gray in life, you know?
Yeah.
That's the biggest problem with, like, politics and business and everything out there. It's either this or that. It's not like, well, maybe somewhere in the middle.
You don't think so?
I think with different topics, there are different ways of going about it. Or if with different constituencies that you want to reach, there are different ways of going about it.
In terms of creating an event?
What channels you use, how you create the event, how you create the message that you intend to have repeated, all sorts of things. I mean, if you wanted to get to poorer people, for instance, I think you would have to find a way to get that information on television, because most of the unconnected people in the country are poor.
You almost could look at protest and activism as a type of paramedia event. You know, look at something on a very, very local level. Say they're going to, like, you know, close a park to put in a parking lot. You know, all the kids and all the PTA and everyone's going to come out against it and start essentially doing a paramedia type activity of talking about it, writing about it, taking pictures of it, well, ad blogs and such into the mix. And now this event that did not exist yesterday exists today, and thus the paramedia line. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong on trying to create an analogy here, Mitch.
Yeah, I just, again, it's the fact that it's either organized or self-organized and has some goal in mind. I mean, it's not simply the fact that everybody happens to say the same thing. There is some intentionality involved in this.
Is there...
I think that's the distinction, is that if somebody... something that emerges that's, you know, pure evil is, you know... I mean, okay, there's not a lot you can do about that, but because we live in this really, really accessible dialogue, I think that pure evil will generally be beaten down by people's goodness. And that is probably the most idealized, optimistic thing I will ever say in my life now that I've heard it come out of my mouth.
Is there an aspect of paramedia in the current concept of tagging?
You know, if you used tagging as a tool for amplifying a message purposefully, that is, you know, we're all going to tag this, we're going to tag it in such a way that it gets automatically picked up in these other places, and that's going to help us get our message out, I think it would be one of the tools that a paramedia would use. But tagging in and of itself is just another tool.
Well, then how do you view tagging, then? Well, if you say it's just another tool, how do you view tagging in this entire, let's say, just digital sphere, since the only people who have a concept of this are bloggers?
If I had an idealized system, I mean, one of the things that I would use is tagging to amplify whatever message I was going to put out there.
You know, there's accidental tagging. I mean, if people have taken pictures of their cat, they're going to tag it cat, and that's going to all bubble up to the topic to go, hey, a lot of people are talking about cats. Not necessarily an intention there. You know, if there's a newsworthy event, like the hurricanes, you know, someone's going to tag it, Katrina, and that's going to bubble up to the top, and you get to see what the collective consciousness is. Intentionally doing it? Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, anytime you write something or you put up a show or you want to tag it podcasting so it'll show up higher in the sidebar on, like, Technorati, that's...
Yeah, well, using Katrina, you know, you could tag it Katrina. Or you could tag it Katrina and Bush sucks. And then you're appealing to a group of people who are looking for a reason to think that Bush sucks more.
Adam.
It'd be really simple.
I think it's okay to be simplistic at this point. Because the idea of media is... It is simplistic, in the fact, insofar as it already exists. This is not something that's, you know, so nebulous that you shouldn't be able to wrap your mind around.
Right.
And you've used certain examples of paramedia in action, and I think that the case that you even used in your dialogue, both written and in your podcast, was the Jeff Jarvis episode with Dell.
Mm-hmm.
When talking about paramedia, who do you feel has really picked up on this? I mean, beyond, we're obviously engaging in a conversation here, but have you seen it gain any traction thus far, considering that you just kind of plopped it onto the scape here just a couple of days ago?
Well, Jeff picked up on it. That immediately got him a whole bunch of links. He actually ranks higher in paramedia than I do now. I think, look, I sent it out to a bunch of people at the same time and said, hey, take a look at this. In a sense, I tried to my best to create some sort of emerging paramedia effort, around the idea of this idea of paramedia. But I'm just not very devious. I'm sort of, I'll put the idea out there and I'll let it live or die on its own. Unfortunately, I still have a big media, mindset. But the, again, I just want to say, paramedia is not the tools. Paramedia are the organizations using the tools. And that's the big distinction. It's, paramilitaries use guns.
So
the people who use guns are not necessarily paramilitary.
Then what do the paramedia use? Whatever's at the disposal?
Paramedia uses the entire range of media that are available today, to whatever degree they are accessible to the people who are doing it. There are paramilitaries who have access to rifles, and there are paramilitaries who have access to intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Somebody sent me an instant message that said, I am Mr. Paramedia. I don't know what I think about that.
That you are yourself?
Sure.
I mean, Eric Rice himself is Mr. Paramedia, the king of paramedia. Well, now,
I mean, in the context of using every possible type of tool around me to, put out text, audio, video, whatever.
But thing is, again, it goes back to leadership. I mean, that's leadership. But whether or not it gets picked up and amplified, and that network that evolves around that message and around that leadership is the thing that defines whether or not it's a person talking, or whether it's a network collaborating to drive a message forward, which would be a paramedia according to my, you know, I sound like I'm trying to write the dictionary definition, but you know, basically,
well,
I am.
So basically, dig is a paramedia itself, using media to get the message out, but in and of itself being a sender or these groups.
As it is both an aggregation and distribution point for ideas, and that those ideas can be focused by groups of people influencing the tagging, the flow of information by using tagging. Yeah, it could be considered in and of itself a paramedia, but I think that because it's available for anybody to use in any number of ways at any time, I would still relegate it to the category of tool.
Isn't a user of Dig more potentially a paramilitary
paramedia?
Or paramedia? they could be paramilitary too, but paramedia as opposed to actual tool Dig itself, because it would make more sense for somebody to try to use Dig to draw attention to an idea rather than Dig trying to draw attention to ideas.
Yeah, I think so. You know, and it's funny because today there was a news story about the fact that Al-Qaeda is advertising on the web for webmasters, and that this is serious and legitimate. This is really Al-Qaeda saying, you know, we really need help getting the story out to all the Muslim brothers out there.
How much are they paying?
They're probably on Craigslist.
I don't know. But, you know, the thing is, I thought to myself, geez, they run ads, and we can't infiltrate this organization? It's tools and it's intention. And intention, you know, can be applied in a lot of different ways. I mean, the other things I've been thinking about is, you know, there's a Second Amendment movement in the country. You know, it's the National Rival Association. What we really need is our First Amendment movement that says, you know, unbridled free speech is the best possible thing we could have. And so when, like, this kid who got a visit from the Secret Service today because he submitted a picture to a Walmart that he had taken for a class project that was supposed to show what propaganda looks like, he took a picture of George Bush, tacked it to the wall with a red tack through George Bush's forehead, and took a picture of the picture and his thumb in a downward gesture. That picture ends up getting the kid a visit from the Secret Service, and that's an indication that this society does not tolerate free speech.
Or it's an indication that Republicans work at Walmart.
Well, that too, but you know, the thing is, there are a lot of polling data that show that younger people these days think that free speech goes too far. And we should be saying, you know, keep your hands off my press, whatever form that press takes, and, you know, let ideas have their day and their say, and let them battle it out in the court of public opinion, not in the court of the United States where the Republicans are in charge, or in the United States where the Democrats are in charge. Let's keep this free and let's use it. You know, the obligation that rises with making that claim is that we also need greater systems of transparency so that you can't just smear somebody or smear ideas anonymously. You know, there's a lot of new aspects of being able to speak to a large audience that has never been available to individuals before, that we assume means that we can still act like, you know, I'm just talking to somebody over the back fence and I'm not doing any harm at all.
So the Patriot Act doesn't fit very well into this idea of paramedia. Well, I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. How would a paramedia, I guess, group successfully topple or reverse the idea of a Patriot Act, since it seems to be, you know, anti-paramedia?
You could do it a lot of ways. I mean, you could do it by recording every bad thing that happened with the Patriot Act.
But hasn't that already been done? And it wasn't very effective.
No, it hasn't been done in any systematic way. It's done very loosely. There isn't a site that, you know, does a good job of aggregating a feed about how horrible the Patriot Act is. I mean, if it's out there, I haven't found it to subscribe to it. And if it's out there, it hasn't done a good job of getting itself repeated. So, you know, the point is, you got to do better than that.
But what if people don't know. I mean, I talk to a lot of people, and they wonder, well, what's, you know, what's the method to the madness? How do you get from point A to point B? A lot of people don't have the wherewithal or understanding about how to do it. You know, especially with a large percentage of people now online are increasingly getting to the point where they're either blogging to a certain degree, or, you know, podcasting or sharing their thoughts, but they don't necessarily know how to break through the ice, if you will, and be someone who stands out. Be a hub or a voice that stands out among the rest.
Well, so what we need is the First Amendment version of the NRA. We need the National Press Association, but, you know, with a better name than that, something that conveys the individuality and the freedom involved. We need an organization that's out there making all that available. There have been some really good pieces, you know, made available for how to avoid censorship in totalitarian countries, circulated recently for bloggers. But there's, you know, really just nothing of course, look, we're 5 years into this, too, so this is probably understandable. There's not a whole lot of information out there. But it would be great to find the resources that made that kind of information available, that said, you know, if you want to get your topic to the top of a Google listing, here's how to do it. I think what we really need is transparency on Google's algorithm in the first place, but that's another story entirely.
I think there's some work being done in that in very small capacities. I mean, that's part of the reason why I focus on entertainment, is because I don't have to worry about the accountability of doing serious stuff. If I can bundle up what it is that I do and say, well, boom, here's the formula, go nuts politically, go nuts economic, go nuts with whatever you want to do, take this formula and go. You know, there's lots of R&D being done in really small microcosms, but yeah, we're just not at a point yet where everything's all, you know, unified effort, click, done.
Well, you know who's done paramedia better than anybody else? Spammers.
The neoconservatives.
Spammers. Yes. Spammers. They know how to use the system to get their message out, and they do it to an extreme degree, but I think they're a prime example of paramedia. Personally, from my take, my angle.
Except they only use one channel, at least right
well,
now.
Well, no. I mean, I term a spammer as someone who's, you know, trying to... you can spam my inbox. You could also spam my blog. Spammers will use electronic... You can spam news groups, forums.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I mean,
I got to tell you, I mean, I'm really concerned about my penis after years of exposure.
I have about 47 cases of Cialis laying around here. I don't even know what to do with it.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Way too much information.
Guys.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
All right, see ya.
Certainly. And, Mitch, we don't want to take up, you know, you've definitely spent, you know, more time than I could have ever, you know, hoped for.
Happy to do this.
No, it's a concept that I find very, very interesting. Like I said, you really put a word to something that's been around for a while, a concept that really had yet to be defined, at least put into a word that we could then use to explain what exactly that particular thing is.
Well, you know, the only thing I can ask in return is that everybody who's listening start pointing at my blog and to that posting and to the podcast of it, so that people can listen and this idea will spread, and then we'll all become a paramedia of our own. Because now you can belong to more than one paramedia at a time.
And also so that you can beat Jeff Jarvis in relation to the word.
Yeah, well, that would be good too, just for the fun of it.
Although I think
competitiveness is a good thing.
Oh, of course. Without competition, something grows stagnant. Always. But anyway, yeah.
But thanks, guys.
Yeah, no
appreciate
problem,
it.
Mitch. No, we really appreciate it. Certainly.
All right.
Take care.
The Windows Media stream for the live broadcast of The Chris Perillo Show is provided by Limelight Networks. Listen to the live Chris Perillo Show in Windows Media Player. Download the latest version of the player for Mac and Windows users at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.